Chapter 12. The State. C. Philosophy of Politics. 1. To politics as an idea, we have given more thought than has been good for us, since, correspondingly, we have understood all the less about the observation of politics as a reality. The great statesmen are accustomed to act immediately and on the basis of a sure flair for facts. This is so self-evident to them that it simply never enters their heads to reflect upon the basic general principles of their action, supposing indeed that such exist. In all ages they have known what they had to do, and any theory of this knowledge has been foreign to both their capacities and their tastes. But the professional thinkers who have turned their attention to the fait accompli of men have been so remote inwardly from these actions that they have just spun for themselves a web of abstractions. For preference, abstraction myths like justice, virtue, freedom, and then applied them as criteria to past and especially future historical happening. Thus, in the end, they have forgotten that concepts are only concepts, and brought themselves to the conclusion that there is a political science whereby we can form the course of the world according to an ideal recipe. As nothing of the kind has ever or anywhere happened, political doing has come to be considered as so trivial in comparison with abstract thinking that they debate in their books whether there is a genius of action at all. Here, on the contrary, the attempt will be made to give, instead of an ideological system, a physiognomy of politics as it has actually been practiced in the course of general history, and not as it might or ought to have been practiced. The problem was, and is, to penetrate to the final meaning of great events, to see them, to feel, and to transcribe the symbolically important in them. The projects of world improvers and the actuality of history have nothing to do with one another. Footnote. Empires perish, but a good verse stands, said W. von Humboldt on the field of Waterloo. But all the same, the personality of Napoleon performed the history of the next century. Good verses, he should have questioned a peasant by the wayside. They stand for literary teaching. Plato is eternal for philologists. But Napoleon inwardly rules us, all of us, our states and our armies, our public opinion, the whole of our political outlook, and the more effectually, the less we are conscious of it. End of footnote. The being streams of humanity are called history when we regard them as movement, and family, estate, people, nation, when we regard them as the object moved. Politics is the way in which this fluent being maintains itself, grows, triumphs over other life streams. All living is politics, in every trait of instinct, in the inmost marrow. That which we nowadays like to call life energy, vitality, the it in us that at all costs strives forward and upward, the blind cosmic drive to validity and power that at the same time remains plant-wise and race-wise bound up with the earth, the homeland. The directedness, the need to actualize, it is this that appears in every higher mankind as its political life, seeking naturally and inevitably the great decisions that determine whether it shall be or shall suffer a destiny. For it grows or it dies out. There is no third possibility. For this reason, the nobility, as expression of a strong race quality, is the truly political order, and training and not shaping is the truly political sort of education. Every great politician, a centre of forces in the stream of happening, has something of the noble in his feeling of self-vocation and inward obligation. On the other hand, all that is microcosmic and intellect is unpolitical, and so there is something of priestliness in all program politics and ideology. The best diplomats are the children. In their play, or when they want something, a cosmic it that is bound up in the individual being breaks out immediately and with the sure tread of the sleepwalker. They do not learn, but unlearn, this art of early years as they grow older. Hence the rarity in the world of adults of the statesman. It is only in and between these being streams that fill the field of the high culture that high policy exists. They are only possible, therefore, in the plural. A people is, really, only in relation to peoples. But the natural race, relation between them, is for that very reason a relation of war. This is a fact that no truths avail to alter. War is the primary politics of everything that lives, and so much so that in the deeps battle and life are one, and being and will to battle expire together. Old Germanic words for this, like orista and orlog, mean seriousness and destiny in contrast to jest and play, and the contrast is one of intensity, not of qualitative difference. And even though all high politics tries to be a substitution of more intellectual weapons for the sword, and though it is the ambition of the statesman at the culminations of all the cultures to be able to dispense with war, yet the primary relationship between diplomacy and the war art endures. The character of battle is common to both, and the tactics and stratagems, and the necessity of material forces in the background to give weight to the operations. The aim, too, remains the same, namely the growth of one's own life unit, class or nation, at the cost of the others. And every attempt to eliminate the race element only leads to its transfer to other ground. Instead of the conflict of states, we have that of parties, or that of areas, or, if there also the will to growth is extinct, that of the adventurer's retinues, to whose doings the rest of the population unresistingly adjusts itself. In every war between life powers, the question at issue is which is to govern the whole. It is always a life, never a system, law, or program that gives the beat in the stream of happening. This is what is expressed in the English proverb, "Men, not measures," which is the very key to the secrets of all political achievement. To be the centre of action and effective focus of a multitude, to make the inward form of one's own personality into that of whole peoples and periods, to be history's commanding officer, with the aim of bringing one's own people or family or purposes to the top of events, that is the scarce conscious but irresistible impulse in every individual being that has a historical vocation in it. There is only personal history, and consequently only personal politics. The struggle of not principles but men, not ideals but race qualities for executive power, is the alpha and omega. Even revolutions are no exception, for the sovereignty of the people only expresses the fact that the ruling power has assumed the title of people's leader instead of that of king. The method of governing is scarcely altered thereby, and the position of the governed not at all. And even world peace, in every case where it has existed, has been nothing but the slavery of an entire humanity under the regimen imposed by a few strong natures determined to rule. The conception of executive power implies that the life unit, even in the case of animals, is subdivided into subjects and objects of government. This is so self-evident that no mass unit has ever for a moment, even in the severest crises, such as 1789, lost the sense of this inner structure of itself. Only the incumbent vanishes, not the office, and if a people does actually, in the tide of events, lose all leadership and float on haphazard, it only means that control has passed to outside hands, that it has become in its entirety the mere object. politically gifted peoples do not exist. Those which are supposed to be so are simply peoples that are firmly in the hands of a ruling minority, and in consequence feel themselves to be in good form. The English, as a people, are just as unthinking, narrow, and unpractical in political matters as any other nation, but they possess, for all their liking for public debate, a tradition of confidence. The difference is simply that the Englishman is the object of a regimen of very old and successful habits, in which he acquiesces because experience has shown him their advantage. From an acquiescence that has the outward appearance of agreement, it is only one step to the conviction that this government depends upon his will, although paradoxically it is the government that, for technical reasons of its own, unceasingly hammers the notion into his head. The ruling class in England has developed its aims and methods quite independently of the people, and it works with and within an unwritten constitution of which the refinements, which have arisen from practice and are wholly innocent of theory, are to the uninitiated as opaque as they are unintelligible. But the courage of a troop depends on its confidence in the leadership, and confidence means involuntary abstention from criticism. It is the officer who makes cowards into heroes, or heroes into cowards. And this holds good equally for armies, peoples, classes, and parties. Political talent in a people is nothing but confidence in its leading. But that confidence has to be acquired. It will ripen only in its own good time, and success will stabilize it and make it into a tradition. What appears as a lack of the feeling of certainty in the ruled is really lack of leadership talent in the ruling classes, which generates that sort of uninstinctive and meddlesome criticism which, by its very existence, shows that a people has got out of condition. 2. How is politics done? The born statesman is above all a valuer of men, situations, and things. He has the eye which unhesitatingly and inflexibly embraces the round of possibilities. The judge of horses takes in an animal with one glance and knows what prospects it will have in a race. To do the correct thing without knowing it, to have the hands that imperceptibly tighten or ease the bit, his talent is the very opposite to that of the man of theory. The secret pulse of all being is one and the same in him and in the things of history. They sense one another. They exist for one another. The fact man is immune from the risk of practicing sentimental or program politics. He does not believe in the big words. Pilate's question is constantly on his lips. Truths? The born statesman stands beyond true and false. He does not confuse the logic of events with the logic of systems. Truths or errors, which here amount to the same, only concern him as intellectual currents and in respect of workings. He surveys their potency, durability, and direction, and duly books them in his calculations for the destiny of the power that he directs. He has convictions, certainly, that are dear to him, but he has them as a private person. No real politician ever felt himself tied to them when in action. The doer is always conscienceless. No one has a conscience except the spectator, said Goethe. And it is equally true of Sulla and Robespierre as it is of Bismarck and Pitt. The great popes and the English party leaders, so long as they had still to strive for the mastery of things, acted on the same principles as the conquerors and upstarts of all ages. Take the dealings of Innocent III, who very nearly succeeded in creating a world dominion of the Church, and deduce therefrom the catechism of success. It will be found to be in the extremest contradiction with all religious moral. Yet without it, there could have been no bearable existence for any church, not to mention English colonies, American fortunes, victorious revolutions, or for that matter, states or parties or peoples in general. It is life, not the individual, that is conscienceless. The essential, therefore, is to understand the time for which one is born. He who does not sense and understand its most secret forces, who does not feel in himself something cognate that drives him forward on a path neither hedged nor defined by concepts, who believes in the surface, public opinion, large phrases and ideals of the day, he is not of the stature for its events. He is in their power, not they in his. Look not back to the past for measuring rods, still less sideways for some system or other. There are times, like our own present and the Gracchan age, in which there are two most deadly kinds of idealism, the reactionary and the democratic. The one believes in the reversibility of history, the other in the teleology of history. But it makes no difference to the inevitable failure with which both burden a nation over whose destiny they have power, whether it is to a memory or to a concept that they sacrifice it. The genuine statesman is incarnate history, its directedness expressed as individual will and its organic logic as character. But the true statesman must also be, in a large sense of the word, an educator, not the representative of a moral or a doctrine, but an exemplar in doing. It is a patent fact that a religion has never yet altered the style of an existence. It penetrated the waking consciousness, the intellectual man. It threw new light on another world. It created an immense happiness by way of humanity, resignation, and patience unto death. But over the forces of life it possessed no power. In the sphere of the living, only the great personality, the it, the race, the cosmic force bound up in that personality has been creative, not shaping, but breeding and training, and has effectively modified the type of entire classes and peoples. It is not the truth, or the good, or the upright, but the Roman, or the Puritan, or the Prussian, that is a fact. The sum of honour and duty, discipline, resolution, is a thing not learnt from books, but awakened in the stream of being by a living exemplar. And that is why Frederick William I was one of those educators, great for all time, whose personal race-forming conduct does not vanish in the course of the generations. The genuine statesman is distinguished from the mere politician, the player who plays for the pleasure of the game, the arriviste on the heights of history, the seeker after wealth and rank, as also from the schoolmaster of an ideal, by the fact that he dares to demand sacrifices and obtains them because his feeling that he is necessary to the time and the nation is shared by thousands, transforms them to the core, and renders them capable of deeds to which otherwise they could never have risen. Footnote. The same, too, holds good of the churches, which are different in kind from the religion, namely elements of the world of facts, and therefore political and not religious in the type of their leadership. It was not the Christian evangel, but the Christian martyr who conquered the world, and that which gave him his strength was not the doctrine, but the example of the man on the cross. End of footnote. Highest of all, however, is not action, but the ability to command. It is this that takes the individual up out of himself and makes him the centre of a world of action. There is one kind of commanding that makes obedience a proud, free, and noble habit. That kind Napoleon, for example, did not possess. A residue of subaltern outlook in him prevented him from training men to be men and not bureau personnel, and led him to govern through edicts instead of through personalities. As he did not understand this subtlest tact of command and therefore was obliged to do everything really decisive himself, he slowly collapsed from inability to reconcile the demands of his position with the limit of human capabilities. But one who, like Caesar or Frederick the Great, possesses this last and highest gift of complete humanity, feels, on a battle evening, when operations are sweeping to the willed conclusion, and the victory is turning out to be conclusive of the campaign, or when the last signature is written that rounds off a historical epoch, a wondrous sense of power that the man of truths can never know. There are moments, and they indicate the maxima of cosmic flowings, when the individual feels himself to be identical with destiny, the centre of the world, and his own personality seems to him almost as a covering in which the history of the future is about to clothe itself. The first problem is to make oneself somebody. The second, less obvious, but harder and greater in its ultimate effects, to create a tradition, to bring on others so that one's work may be continued with one's own pulse and spirit, to release a current of like activity that does not need the original leader to maintain it in form. And here the statesman rises to something that in the classical world would doubtless have been called divinity. He becomes the creator of a new life, the spirit ancestor of a young race. He himself, as a unit, vanishes from the stream after a few years, but a minority called into being by him takes up his course and maintains it indefinitely. This cosmic something, this soul of a ruling stratum, an individual can generate and leave as a heritage, and throughout history it is this that has produced the durable effects. The great statesman is rare. Whether he comes or wins through, too soon or too late, incident determines. Great individuals often destroy more than they have built up by the gap that their death makes in the flow of happening. But the creation of tradition means the elimination of the incident. A tradition breeds a high average with which the future can reckon. No Caesar, but a Senate. No Napoleon, but an incomparable officer corps. A strong tradition attracts talents from all quarters, and out of small gifts produces great results. The schools of painting of Italy and Holland are proof of this, no less than the Prussian army and the diplomacy of the Roman Curia. It was the great flaw in Bismarck, as compared with Frederick William I, that he could achieve but could not form a tradition, that he did not parallel Moltke's officer corps by a corresponding race of politicians who would identify themselves in feeling with his state and its new tasks, would constantly take up good men from below, and so provide for the continuance of the Bismarckian action pulse forever. If this creation of a tradition does not come off, then instead of a homogeneous ruling stratum, we have a congeries of heads that are helpless when confronted by the unforeseen. If it does, we have a sovereign people in the one sense of the phrase that is worthy of a people and possible in the world of fact, a highly trained, self-replenishing minority with sure and slowly ripened traditions which attracts every talent into the charmed circle and uses it to the full, and ipso facto keeps itself in harmony with the remainder of the nation that it rules. Such a minority slowly develops into a true breed, even when it had begun merely as a party, and the sureness of its decisions comes to be that of blood, not of reason. But this means that what happens in it happens of itself, and does not need the genius. Great politics, so to put it, takes the place of the great politician. What then is politics? It is the art of the possible, an old saying, and almost an all-inclusive saying. The gardener can obtain a plant from the seed, or he can improve its stock. He can bring to bloom, or let languish the dispositions hidden in it, its growths and colour, its flower and fruit. On his eye for possibilities, and therefore necessities, depends its fulfilment, its strength, its whole destiny. But the basic form and direction of its being, the stages and tempo and direction thereof, are not in his power. It must accomplish them, or it decays. And the same is true of the immense plant that we call a culture, and the being streams of human families that are bound up in its form world. The great statesman is the gardener of a people. Every doer is born in a time and for a time, and thereby the ambit of his attainable achievement is fixed. For his grandfather, for his grandson, the data, and therefore the task and the object, are not the same. The circle is further narrowed by the limits of his personality, the properties of his people, the situation, and the men with whom he has to work. It is the hallmark of the high politician that he is rarely caught out in a misappreciation of this limit, and equally rarely overlooks anything realizable within it. With this, one cannot too often repeat, especially to Germans, goes a sure discrimination between what ought to be and what will be. The basic forms of the state and of political life, the direction and the degree of their evolution, are given values unalterably dependent on the given time. They are the track of political success and not its goal. On the other hand, the worshippers of political ideals create out of nothing. Their intellectual freedom is astounding, but their castles of the mind, built of airy concepts like wisdom and righteousness, liberty and equality, are in the end all the same. They are built from the top story downwards. The master of fact, for his part, is content to direct imperceptibly that which he sees and accepts as plain reality. This does not seem very much, yet it is the very starting point of freedom in a grand sense of the word. The knack lies in the little things, the last careful touch of the helm, the fine sensing of the most delicate oscillations of collective and individual souls. The art of the statesman consists not only in a clear idea of the main lines drawn undeviably before him, but also in the sure handling of the single occurrences and the single persons encountered along those lines, which can turn an impending disaster into a decisive success. The secret of all victory lies in the organization of the non-obvious. An adept in the game can, like Talleyrand, go to Vienna as ambassador of the vanquished party and make himself master of the victor. At the Lucca meeting, Caesar, whose position was well nigh desperate, not only made Pompey's power serviceable to his own ends, but undermined it at the same time, and without his opponents becoming aware of the fact. But the domain of the possible has dangerous edges, and if the finished tact of the great Baroque diplomatists almost always managed to keep clear, it is the very privilege of the ideologues to be always stumbling over it. There have been turns in history in which the state's craftsman has let himself drift with the current a while in order not to lose the leadership. Every situation has its elastic limit, and in the estimation of that limit, not the smallest error is permissible. A revolution that reaches explosion point is always a proof of lack of the political pulse in the governors and in their opponents. Further, the necessary must be done opportunely, namely, while it is a present wherewith the governing power can buy confidence in itself, whereas if it has to be conceded as a sacrifice, it discloses a weakness and excites contempt. Political forms are living forms whose changes inexorably follow a definite direction, and to attempt to prevent this course, or to divert it towards some ideal, is to confess oneself out of condition. The Roman nobility possessed this congruence of pulse, the Spartan did not. In the period of mounting democracy, we find again and again, as in France before 1789 and Germany before 1918, the arrival of a fatal moment when it is too late for the necessary reform to be given as a free gift. Then that which should be refused with the sternest energy is given as a sacrifice, and so becomes the sign of dissolution. But those who fail to detect the first necessity in good time will all the more certainly fail to misunderstand the second situation. Even a journey to Canossa can be made too soon or too late. The timing may settle the future of whole peoples, whether they shall be destiny for others or themselves the objects of another's destiny. But the declining democracy also repeats the same error of trying to hold what was the ideal of yesterday. This is the danger of our 20th century. On the path towards Caesarism, there is ever a Cato to be found. The influence that a statesman, even one in an exceptionally strong position, possesses over the methods of politics is very small. And it is one of the characteristics of the high-grade statesman that he does not deceive himself on this matter. His task is to work in and with the historical form that he finds in existence. It is only the theorist who enthusiastically searches for more ideal forms. But to be politically in form means necessarily, amongst other things, an unconditional command of the most modern means. There is no choice about it. The means and methods are premises pertaining to the time and belong to the inner form of the time. And one who grasps at the inapposite, who permits his taste or his feelings to overpower the pulse in him, loses at once his grip of realities. The danger of an aristocracy is that of being conservative in its means. The danger of a democracy is the confusion of formula and form. The means of the present are, and will be for many years, parliamentary, elections, and the press. He may think what he pleases about them, he may respect them or despise them, but he must command them. Bach and Mozart commanded the musical means of their times. This is the hallmark of mastery in any and every field, and statecraft is no exception. Now, the publicly visible outer form thereof is not essential, but merely the disguise, and consequently it may be altered, rationalized, and brought down to constitutional texts, without its actualities being necessarily affected in the slightest, and hence the ambitions of all revolutionaries expend themselves in playing the game of rights, principles, and franchises on the surface of history. But the statesman knows that the extension of a franchise is quite unimportant in comparison with the technique, Athenian or Roman, Jacobin or American or present-day German, of operating the votes. How the English Constitution reads is a matter of small import compared with the fact that it is managed by a small stratum of high families, so that an Edward VII is simply a minister of his ministry. And as for the modern press, the sentimentalist may beam with contentment when it is constitutionally free, but the realist merely asks at whose disposal it is. Politics, lastly, is the form in which is accomplished the history of a nation within a plurality of nations. The great art is to maintain one's own nation inwardly in form for events outside. This is the natural relation of home and foreign politics, holding not only for peoples and states and estates, but for living units of every kind, down to the simplest animal swarms and down into the individual bodies. And as between the two, the first exists exclusively for the second, and not vice versa. The true democrat is accustomed to treat home politics as an end in itself. The rank and file of diplomats think solely of foreign affairs. But just because of this, the individual success of either cut no ice. No doubt the political master exhibits his powers most obviously in the tactics of home reform, in his economic and social activities, in his cleverness in maintaining the public form of the whole, the rights and liberties, both in tune with the tastes of the period and at the same time effective, and in the education of the feelings without which it is impossible for a people to be in condition, namely trust, respect for the leading, consciousness of power, contentment, and, when necessary, enthusiasm. But the value of all this depends upon its relation to this basic fact of higher history, that a people is not alone in the world, and that its future will be decided by its force relationships towards other peoples and powers, and not by its mere internal ordering. And since the ordinary man is not so long-sighted, it is the ruling minority that must possess this quality on behalf of the rest. And not unless there is such a minority does the statesman find the instrument wherewith he can carry his purposes into effect. Footnote. It should scarcely need to be emphasized that this is the basic principle not of an aristocratic regime, but of government itself. Cleon, Robespierre, Lenin, every gifted mass leader, has treated his office thus. Anyone who genuinely felt himself as the delegate of the multitude, instead of as the regent of such as do not know what they want, would not remain master of his house for one day. The only question is whether the great popular leaders apply their powers for their own benefit or for that of others. And on that much might be said. End of footnote.